Anthony Shadid has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for his coverage of conflict in Iraq, so he's no stranger to reporting from war zones. But I suspect that he wasn't prepared for what happened on March 16th, when he and 3 colleagues from the New York Times were captured by forces loyal to Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. He joins us now to talk about their ordeal during their 6 days as prisoners in Libya. And Tony, welcome back to our show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
I'm sure we weren't the only ones, but I have to say that when we read about you, we were very worried. Did you assume that everything was going to work out okay in the end?
You know, we weren't sure. I tell you, that was the kind of most maddening thing about the ordeal, was that you weren't certain when it was going to come to an end. You know, I was pretty sure the New York Times wasn't going to forget about us. Beyond that, I was having, you know, kind of some dark thoughts about staying for long months and under custody.
Well, you're the New York Times Beirut bureau chief. How did you wind up going to Libya? Did you request to go?
Well, you know, there's 2 of us in the Middle East from the New York Times, me and my colleague David Kirkpatrick, and then obviously other people are coming in to cover the tumult that we've been seeing, and, you know, starting with Tunisia, then Egypt, then Libya. I had gone back to do some reporting in Egypt, and, you know, I thought I should probably, you know, at least spend at least a week in Libya just to get a sense of what was happening there. I think what's so remarkable about all this change in the Arab world is how interconnected it is, how interrelated it is. So I was hoping to get a sense of Libya, you know, and its repercussions in Egypt, perhaps. You know, the plan was to stay for just a week, and, of course, you know, end up staying a lot longer.
Well, are you happy with the concept of parachute journalism? Had you spent any time in Libya prior to covering the conflict there?
You know, I had been to Libya 15 years ago, and I have to say, I don't think anyone has a lot of experience covering Libya. It was one of the toughest places to get into, you know, very difficult to get a visa. Usually visas were only granted to cover a conference, say, or an anniversary or a commemoration of Colonel Gaddafi's coming to power. So I don't think anyone had a real deep sense, at least journalistically, of Libya. And, so we're all starting from scratch in one respect or another. It was the first time, I think, you know, at least, you know, for journalists of my generation, that you could get into the country without a visa. Of course, us entering without a visa was the reason we were held for that week.
Well, you said you were there 15 years ago. Of course, you can't compare a situation where there's no fighting with a situation where there's a lot of fighting. But had you seen, did you notice any changes?
You know, what I had, I think what was familiar to me was just, you know, I have to be blunt about this, just how utterly bizarre Colonel Gaddafi's rule really is. And, you know, you saw that in Tripoli 15 years ago. You saw the wreckage of it, I think, you know, that week that we were being held, and then the week before when I was reporting with the rebellion. It was, you know, it's hard to overstate what kind of legacy that's going to leave. And I think there eventually is going to be a reckoning of some sort, you know, a reckoning of some sort with that legacy.
Well, he comes across as bizarre to Westerners, all of the different outfits that he wears and the changes in the facial hair and, of course, some of the weird things he says in his speeches. Have Libyans been aware of that, or is this only a recent show of dissatisfaction?
Absolutely. I mean, I think what struck me so early on in the reporting in eastern Libya, at least in these opposition-held areas, was that there was almost a sense of embarrassment, that people were embarrassed for having lived for so many years under Colonel Gaddafi, that, you know, they deserved better, that they should have had better, that they, maybe, you know, perhaps even should have risen up earlier than they did. But then there's that kind of divorce in reality. And, you know, another thing, if it's another anecdote, was there's a speech that became quite famous that Colonel Gaddafi gave early in the uprising, where he said he was going to, you know, the fight was going to go, you know, street to street, house to house, and they used a phrase in Arabic, you know, zenga zenga, which means like alley to alley, basically. Now, in the east, in these opposition-held areas, it became almost a joke. Anytime you would say zenga zenga, people would start laughing. It was just this kind of more craziness from Colonel Gaddafi. When we got transported to the west, to Tripoli, which is very firmly being held by the government, this zenga zenga became a rallying cry. It was on people's cell phones. It was their ringtone. And so what had become kind of the butt of jokes in the east was actually, it was in fact, you know, kind of, you know, you know, grist for incitement in the West, in the areas that Colonel Gaddafi was still in power.
There was an uprising in the 1990s that was crushed, wasn't there? And there was little of an international repercussion. So do you think that Gaddafi thought he could do the same thing again?
I think there was that sense, absolutely. I think he thought that if he did it brutally enough, the one in the 90s wasn't quick. I don't want to say quick enough, because the predecessor didn't end quickly. But, you know, brutally enough, if he sealed, you know, was able to seal the country as tight as he could. And then, you know, I think some of Colonel Gaddafi doesn't really care what the rest of the world thinks either. I mean, I don't want to overstate that because there have been exceptions, but I think he thought he could, you know, he could just kind of tough this one out. I think mentioning that uprising in the 90s is really relevant to what's going on in Libya today, in fact. And it's there are veterans from that fight who are in the rebel ranks. I think there's some experience that they have. It is one of the fault lines in the country right now that, you know, in this very disparate opposition, the kind of, you know, a certain Islamist streak you know, is very entrenched in, you know, within that opposition.
Do you think that people in Tripoli have no choice but to support Gaddafi? Or I'm assuming, as with all dictatorships, there are people who admire the leader.
You know, there are. And I'll tell you one thing, you know, if I can just go back to Iraq, I mean, I don't want to draw too many parallels between Iraq and Libya, but one thing that did strike me in the in that kind of aftermath of the American invasion was how much, you know, how deep I didn't, you know, two things I didn't understand. And one thing was how deep the hatred among politicized Shia towards Saddam Hussein actually ran. And I didn't also understand that there was, you know, a degree of support among Saddam's Sunni constituency. And I think it's probably the same thing in Libya. It's, you know, to some degree. I think he's, people in Libya overwhelmingly want change, but he still does have a support. I think there are supporters, you know, that he can count on who can't imagine Libya without Colonel Gaddafi. And that was even spoken to me by some of these, some of his soldiers. I think there's also an incredible degree of fear in Tripoli right now that people are so scared that they don't think it's worth dying. You know, to speak out is not, they're not going to speak out at the cost of dying, in other words.
Well, there is no Shiite Sunni conflict in Libya, but there are tribal differences, aren't there?
There are, you know, and there, you know, Colonel Gaddafi's support, you know, draws on his clan for a lot of his support. I think what's more telling, though, than and I think this idea of tribal divisions is sometimes misunderstood or maybe overstated. I think what's more relevant to what's happening in Libya today is that for four decades, you know, Colonel Gaddafi has pledged himself to what he describes as perpetual revolution. And it wasn't revolution, it wasn't perpetual, but in the end, it did wipe out any institutions in that country that could navigate a transition away from him. And I think that's the challenge that, that, you know, we're looking at. When we talk about the opposition or the rebel army, even those words overstate how unified it is, how effective it is, how deep it runs. You know, when we're dealing with a country that is going to have a very tough time trying to, you know, navigate a transition after Colonel Gaddafi eventually falls.
My guest is Anthony Shadid, who is the Beirut Bureau Chief for the New York Times. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You, Stephen Farrell, Tyler Hicks, Lindsay Adario, and Yudrava Muhammad were all covering the flight of rebels from the town of Ajdabia. Can you take us through how you were captured by government forces?
You know, we had Steve and I had spent the night before in Benghazi. We'd come down that morning. Tyler and Lindsay had been there overnight. And we were covering what I think all of us thought was going to be a decisive fight in some ways, that if Ajdabia fell and Colonel Gaddafi's troops might march on to Benghazi, they would control a road that guaranteed access to the Egyptian border. So it seemed that it was a story not just about fighting, but it actually, you know, had a broader significance. And we spent the day there going to the hospital, to the front line, interviewing residents in the town, you know, trying to document or, you know, trying to chronicle how residents were fleeing as the fighting got worse. And, you know, in the end, you know, I made a bad call and left too late. And we left after rebels had encircled the town. And we were stopped at a checkpoint around 4:30 in the afternoon. And almost immediately when we were stopped at that checkpoint, a gun battle erupted, and we ran for our lives. Lindsay, Tyler, Steve, and I went out one side of the car, and Muhammad went out the other side of the car. And that was the last time we've seen Muhammad. And, you know, the newspaper was trying to find out what happened to him and determine his whereabouts or his fate, and we haven't been able to do that yet.
Well, aren't drivers and translators always the most vulnerable people in situations like these?
I think they are. I think that's a good point. And I think, you know, we're going to have to carry that burden that the decisions we made brought him to that point. I mean, he believed in what he was doing. I don't doubt that. He was a young man. I think he was eager to do the work, but I don't think he would have ever made the decisions that perhaps cost him his life. I mean, those are decisions that we're responsible for.
Well, all of you, the other journalists, had close calls over the years. Lindsay had been kidnapped in Fallujah, Stephen in Afghanistan, Tyler had scrapes in Chechnya and Sudan, and weren't you shot in the back in 2002?
I was, yes.
So did what happened to you in Libya feel different from those experiences? Did it feel more dangerous, or did you feel, well, gee, we have survived those other situations, this can't be any worse?
Yeah, it's a good question to ask, Leonard, and I'm not sure I know the answer to it. And I've thought about this the past couple of weeks. You know, I think in the past I've always thought that, you know, each story stands on its own, and you know, maybe it's a question of vanity. I don't know, but I mean, I think in past situations, I was in Baghdad in 2003 because I thought if I wasn't there, the story wouldn't be covered. Or let's say in Ramallah in 2002, or Lebanon in 2006. You know, I think part of what was going through my mind that day in Ajdabiya was that if I wasn't in Ajdabiya, you know, the story wasn't going to be covered. I guess the question I'm asking myself right now, though, is did that story need to be covered? And, you know, was it worth the risks we took and, you know, what happened to Muhammad potentially? And I don't know the answer to that. You know, I certainly don't enjoy covering conflict. I think you have to cover conflict when it's part of the story you're covering, which is the Arab world. But I do ask my questions about that. I do ask myself questions about that day in Ajdabiya. You know, I absolutely made the wrong call, but I do wonder if I should have been there in the first place.
Well, this is something that journalists ask a lot, don't they? In fact, tomorrow we will be speaking with the sister of a Russian journalist who's her name, Anna Politkovskaya, who once asked if journalism is worth dying for. You write, no article was worth dying for, but we were too blind to admit it. So is this something that journalists discuss in their downtimes?
Yeah, I don't know if they discuss it in those terms. You know, I guess it's so much more, I guess those questions might be too broad to ask, you know, all that often. I think we ask what the specific risks are of any one story, and that absolutely is part of the conversation. You know, should we leave now? Should we leave later? Should we have stayed as long as we did? And I think, you know, Lindsay, Tyler, Steve and I, that's what we spent 3 days talking about when we were in Tripoli. You know, the story is worth dying for. That's absolutely the case. You know, I suspect that some stories are worth taking risks for, though. And then the question becomes, you know, how much risk?
Well, what blinds journalists to that obvious fact? Politkovskaya was assassinated.
Well, I don't think anyone expects that they're going to be, you know, killed. I certainly didn't think I was going to be shot in Ramallah in 2002. I absolutely didn't think that I was going to be held, you know, in Ajdabiya on that day. I guess, you know, is that bad decision-making? Is that, you know, the lack of understanding of what's going on around you, perhaps? But I don't think any of us think the risks are as bad as they are until we suffer from them.
In a joint article on your captivity, you have written, I'm assuming all of you contributed to this, over the years, all of us had seen men detained, blindfolded, and handcuffed at places like Abu Ghraib or corralled after some operation in Iraq or Afghanistan. Now we were the faceless. We had covered perhaps too dispassionately. So what goes through you all of your minds when you find yourself suddenly being treated like that?
Well, I think, you know, Leonard, that was the one thing that struck me more than anything else, I think. I mean, just as like in terms of observation or in terms of being a reporter as I was going through this experience over that week, it was that, you know, I never had understood, you know, those scenes that I saw of these people, you know, the blindfolds and the handcuffs. I guess I never really related to it in a visceral way. Never understood how disorienting it is to be blindfolded, how, you know, the pain of having your hands bound behind your back with plastic. And it did give me a different, I think, you know, I don't want to overstate it, but it was an insight into, you know, how much we as journalists have to maintain our humanity as we cover inhumanity around us. And that's, I think it's a lesson often worth, you know, reminding ourselves of.
Well, is it difficult?
I think it is difficult.
Did you have each other to help yourselves through that?
We did, and that camaraderie was really important. I think, you know, as journalists in general, when you cover conflict, when you cover this post-September 11th world that we've been covering, it's hard not to have your eyes get calloused at some level. And I think sometimes you do forget the suffering that goes on around you. You know, it was interesting that all four of us had that kind of similar feeling when we you know, the handcuffs and the blindfold that we maybe, you know, we all brought up that point that we hadn't related. We related to it differently now, having gone through it, than we might have in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Do you speak Arabic?
I do.
So did that help at all? Did knowing what people were saying around you put you more or less at ease? Because I would assume that one of the problems that some of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib had was they had no idea what their captors were saying to them.
That's right. You know, when I was on the ground, right after we got seized, right after this gun battle had erupted and we ran behind a concrete shack, I was speaking in Arabic, and almost immediately it set something off in a couple of these soldiers, and they started saying, you know, you're the translator, you're the dangerous one, you're the spy. And I realized that, you know, the Arabic was actually hurting me at that point, and so I started, you know, fumbling with it, and, you know, the worst accent possible I could come up with, and, you know, and trying to speak as broken as possible, because I think it was increasing the suspicion of who I was and what I was doing. I think as time went on, it was essential that you know, Arabic was essential because I was able to communicate with our captors, and, you know, they had someone to interrogate, and the interrogation was, I mean, that's overstating, it was just questioning, but they had someone that they could question, and, you know, did it get us out any sooner? Probably not, but I think it definitely made, you know, some of our experience a little bit easier.
Were you just interrogated? Were you ever beaten?
We were. You know, it's, you know, everything heals, but it was, it usually happened in the very first few moments of meeting a new group of people where the beatings would happen. You know, when we were initially seized, I was headbutted. You know, there was, you know, Tyler and I had blows to the back of the head with rifle butts. I mean, you know, like I said, it healed. I think it was, you know, I think for all of us, it was that kind of uncertainty, the unknown that was more troubling. But those first few days were pretty tough.
What about for Lindsay Addario? Wasn't she sexually assaulted?
Lindsay was repeatedly groped, yes. And she, and I think, you know, I don't want to speak on her behalf of what she went through, but, you know, I think she had a deep fear of being separated from us and taken away from us, and she wasn't. And, you know, I have to say, you know, like I said, it was those first few moments that I think were the most brutal, is probably overstating it, but the roughest.
Because they're setting the tone? They're telling you, watch out, we can hurt you anytime we want?
Yeah, you know, I think so, and I think that's the point where you're dehumanized to the greatest degree. And I think as you restore your humanity in their eyes, the people around you draw on a culture's deeper instinct for generosity. And we were met at moments with generosity and hospitality. I mean, this isn't a cultural thing or kind of a. You're in a context of violence, and violence is visited on the people that I think are often weakest and most dehumanized. And I think we were in that category there for a little while.
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more. I'm talking with Anthony Shadid, Beirut bureau chief of the New York Times, who was held captive for 6 days in Libya, along with three of his colleagues from the New York Times. We will find out what happened when they were in captivity and how they wound up being released as we continue this conversation. Stay with us. We're back with Anthony Shadid, the Beirut bureau chief of the New York Times, who, along with three colleagues, was held for 6 days as prisoners in Libya. You say that the first 3 days were when the bulk of the beatings and the like took place. What changed? Is it because you had become humanized, as you suggested earlier, or had they realized who they were holding prisoner?
Well, I think it's more the latter. I think by that, you know, there was a really kind of uncomfortable night when we were in a town called Sirte, which is Colonel Gaddafi's hometown, and they were questioning me. And as the questioning went on, I realized they had no idea who we were, where we were, you know, who we worked for, where we came from. And I went, you know, back down to the cell that night, you know, kind of worried that this was going to be an ordeal that lasted quite a long time. By the next night, though, we were in Tripoli. We'd been put on a military aircraft, taken to Tripoli, and there was a fight on that tarmac over who would take custody of us. And in the end, we went to the military, the defense ministry, military intelligence. And at that moment that we arrived in their hands, they brought us into a small room, you know, gave us milk and mango juice, of all things. They assured that we'd be treated well, that we were in, as they put it, the protection of the state. And we were treated well. We were, you know, fed well. I mean, the house was a detention center, but it was, you know, it was very comfortable. And from that moment on, they never, you know, they held their promise. They kept their promise. They, you know, we were treated as well as we could have hoped to be.
But right after you were arrested, the soldiers said that you would be delivered to a man they called the doctor. Some referred to him as Dr. Mu'tasim. Isn't he one of Gaddafi's sons?
Well, and that's why I can't quite, I'm still trying to figure that out, Leonard, what exactly happened, because you're right. In that first evening, in fact, we kept on hearing about the doctor, they had to call the doctor, and it was later clear that this was Dr. Mu'tasim, this is one of Colonel Gaddafi's sons.
With a terrible reputation, I gather.
That's right. I mean, he's considered a hardliner, but whatever that term means. But, did that get our delivery to the defense ministry? Perhaps. I mean, did they keep us away from the interior ministry or, our more sinister security services? It may have. I really don't know. And it was hard to hear exactly what was being argued on that tarmac. But, I think our destiny was decided there.
Well, do you think that that was also just said to intimidate you? How aware were you of who he was?
I don't think they're trying to intimidate us. I didn't think they really, I don't think they necessarily knew. I think they were in part trying to figure out what to do with us on their own, and that they thought, well, we have to talk to the doctor. Somebody needs to contact the doctor. I mean, I think this militia answered to him, to Colonel Gaddafi's son, and the only person who was going to make a decision on about us was going to be him.
By the way, there's a link to the reporter's account of the captivity on our show page at WNYC.org. He is one of Gaddafi's. How many sons does Gaddafi have? And does each of them have his own militia with its own rules?
Seven, if I remember right. And I may have got that number wrong, but I want to say seven. And, the ones that you hear of most often are four with their militias. And they've all played, a pretty prominent role in this uprising so far. I mean, Colonel Gaddafi has definitely turned to his sons to maintain what power he has. You wonder how unified those sons are, what they're going to do if the father does eventually go. And, I think it's always a dangerous formula, ambition, a lot of young guys with guns, militias that answer, unto yourself. It's not necessarily a good predictor for stability down the road.
Well, haven't there been reports that some of them are trying to negotiate a settlement?
That's right. And I wonder if they don't turn on each other as well. I think this is a conflict. I mean, unlike Egypt and Tunisia, which were relatively brief when you think about it, when you think about the scope of change and how quickly change unfolded there, I think Libya is a conflict that's going to last a long time, months that could turn into years. And you don't have a real, at least I don't have a real good sense that it's going to be a peaceful struggle.
Well, when you were you covered Egypt earlier, initially, did you think the uprising in Libya would unfold in a similar way?
I think we all, as little as we all knew about Libya, I think watching those first reports of trouble there from Egypt, we had the sense that it could be ugly, that it could get very violent, and it did. I mean, it very quickly spiraled into violence, and I think, primarily because Colonel Gaddafi's troops, mercenaries, however we want to describe them, fired brutally on the crowds of peaceful demonstrators. But it didn't take very many days for us, for you to get a sense that this wasn't going to be Egypt and Tunisia.
One of Gaddafi's sons, Saif al-Islam, has been the public face of the regime. Is he different from his brothers and his father?
I think he wants to be different. But I think when it's the kind of the way we've often looked at Bashar al-Assad, thinking that because he's younger, educated in a different way, can sometimes speak a language that's maybe more familiar to the West, that he somehow, believes differently or will do differently or act differently. And we certainly haven't seen it from Bashar al-Assad, other than cosmetic changes. And I think maybe that hope for Saif al-Islam is a little bit overstated as well. He's very much a product of this regime, whatever that regime is. He's definitely his father's son. And I think if we look back to those early days of the uprising, he was using that same vulgar language that his father was about crushing the rebels and crushing the uprising. So, I think he absolutely sees himself as something different. I don't think the rest of the country necessarily does.
Well, he was educated in England, wasn't he? One would assume that he's aware of how the West is perceiving all of this. You say that Libyan society feels disfigured. Is that a result of Gaddafi's ruling style? And do you think that it's fair to call Libya a modern state?
I think, that's a good question. I never thought of it that way. I mean, I think it's absolutely disfigured by his rule. It was interesting to me in Beda, one of these eastern cities that had been liberated pretty early on. The challenge wasn't about, how do we make a transition? How do we chart this transition? the challenge was, how do we build a state from scratch? And I, you know, time and again in interviews there, you know, the time I spent there, there was this complaint that what they had lived through was 4 decades of managed chaos, you know, 4 decades of managed anarchy. And I think that was kind of Colonel Gaddafi's idea. I mean, I think theoretically he could tout that as perpetual revolution, as, you know, something the world had never seen. I think more practically it was his way to keep, you know, challenges at bay. He was able to beat down any threat to his rule by, you know, not permitting the institutions to be built that could, you know, that could threaten his rule. It's a task moving forward, absolutely. I mean, I think other than the oil company in Libya, you wonder what could step into the breach in the way that the military did in Tunisia and Egypt.
Well, Gaddafi's people are saying that any change cannot be imposed from without by the West. They suggest that there just be a vote. Find out whether the Libyan people want Gaddafi to remain in office.
You know, I wonder how, and I think that touches on a very interesting point, and that's how Western intervention in Libya is going to, you know, what are the repercussions of it going to be? And I think every time we see intervention, Western intervention, American intervention, be it Iraq or Lebanon or any other country, I think we're always haunted eventually by those unintended consequences. And I think we've seen them in places like Lebanon. I mean, you know, Hezbollah rose very much from the ashes of the 1982 Israeli invasion. You know, Al-Qaeda never existed in Iraq until after the American invasion. I'm not saying these things are going to happen in Libya, but I think that that idea that Western intervention is going to push forward the revolution, see Colonel Gaddafi's overthrow, and help with the transition, I think that would be the hopeful scenario. I'm not sure it's going to be the right scenario, though, and I think we're going to have to wait a little while to see what those consequences turn out to be.
You've been in many war zones. What were Gaddafi's forces like? Is this a well-trained, professional-looking military?
You know, they weren't. One thing that strikes you almost immediately is they're not all that different than the rebels. I mean, the rebels were in this kind of mishmash of berets and tracksuits and camouflage jackets. I mean, these guys were very explicitly in uniforms, but you really couldn't tell their rank. You weren't clear on who was the commander. They didn't seem to have all that much training. They very much had that kind of, you know, that tough guy thing that you do when you're young and have a gun. But beyond that, you didn't get a sense you were in a real professional unit. They did have better weapons, though, and I think those weapons were key, and they remain key in how they're fighting the rebellion.
Well, we've heard a lot of about Gaddafi's use of mercenary forces. Were all the loyalists you dealt with Libyans?
As far as we could tell, and I have to say we were blindfolded for a lot of the experience, so, you know, trying to figure out who was tough at times. You know, I didn't see any clear evidence of mercenaries while we were being kept by them.
Did you have many interactions with the rebels before you were captured?
I did, and I, you know, it was very interesting reporting. And one of the frustrating things for me is that, you know, those notebooks that I'd spent, you know, so much time talking to those people were lost, and I really don't have any record of that time. But I think in town after town, in Derna and Beta and Benghazi, Ijdabia even, you know, the sense of optimism and hope that, you know, they're finally going to build something different. You know, it's intoxicating, and I think that hope is, you hear that, you know, pronounced everywhere in the Arab world. I think the reality in Libya is much grimmer, and I think it could continue to be grimmer. And I think even for the opposition, you know, we may see growing divisions within their ranks over what to do and how to go about it, and, you know, ideological differences and so on. But that kind of hopefulness that was, you know, enunciated so strongly in the East, it just stands in marked contrast to this kind of hopelessness that you've seen in the Arab world for so long. And I think it struck a lot of people in Tunisia and Egypt and Libya that, you know, however it turned out, at least people were getting a chance to say what their lives would look like.
But aren't questions being asked now about who the rebels really are and what they want for Libya? The Gaddafi accuses them of being Islamists and al-Qaeda members. And now, as I understand it, the CIA has sent people in to find out just who is supporting them and what their beliefs are.
Yeah, there absolutely are Islamists among them. I mean, I met one guy who had fought in Afghanistan for several years, had taken part in this Islamist uprising in the 1990s against Gaddafi in eastern Libya in the town called Derna. You see them on the front line. I mean, none of them were hostile to us. In fact, they seem kind of, you know, rather welcoming, I think, for journalists because they understood the importance of journalism, that, you know, that their story was going to be communicated to the world through us. So there was never any hostility on their part toward us. But it's a melange of people within the rebel ranks. I mean, and that, you know, computer engineers who would call themselves liberal and secular, you know, fighting alongside, you know, hardened Islamists that, like I said, were Afghan veterans. So, you know, who's going to take the upper hand in that rebellion eventually? You know, who's going to be able to exert leadership, you know, where that leadership comes from? I think those are questions that haven't been answered yet. But, you know, so far they've been able to keep at least a semblance of unity just in pursuit of Colonel Gaddafi's overthrow.
How aware were you of what was happening while you were in captivity? The no-fly zone was imposed while you were being held captive, wasn't it? And then the Libyan foreign minister, Moussa Koussa, defected to the United Kingdom not long after you were released. But did you know about all of these things going on?
You know, it was interesting. The first 3 days we knew nothing. I mean, we had no exposure to anything. We heard fighting, and we were trying to figure out the gunfire. You know, was it celebratory gunfire that Ajdabiya had fallen? I remember hearing on the radio the first night that Benghazi was encircled. It was Libyan, you know, state radio. So you're hearing snippets. And then when we got to Tripoli, they let us watch CNN, actually, for about, you know, I'd probably say an hour or two. And we heard everything going on about the no-fly zone and even our own, that, you know, CNN had even reported that, you know, four New York Times journalists were missing. I think the no-fly zone scared us a little bit. We didn't, you know, I think they saw that we got nervous, that we were, you know, trying to figure out why we were still being reported missing, and they cut the cable to CNN, so we weren't able to watch TV after that except for Libyan state television. But that one night we did get a sense the no-fly zone was coming, and then, you know, we realized it had arrived because, I mean, 2 days later you could hear the anti-aircraft fire in the compound, the military compound we were being kept. So, you know, at some level we were aware of what was happening.
Well, they were aware, obviously, not too long after they took you prisoners of who you were, and I assume they didn't want to do anything that would get them in trouble with New York Times journalists. So why do you think that you weren't released earlier?
Well, the Turkish diplomats who eventually facilitated our release said that they've been told four times that we were going to be freed, four times over Saturday and Sunday, I think, or even Friday night to Sunday morning. You know, I think it was just a diplomat. I mean, I hate to say this, but I think it was diplomatic protocol that was getting in the way. Is, you know, I think as the state crumbles, and it is crumbling in Tripoli, the more it crumbles, you almost get the sense the more people who work for that state want to demonstrate its prestige or, you know, demonstrate that it still remains a state. And I think that was going on in some ways. You know, the idea of just deporting us to the border, sending us in a car wasn't, you know, grand enough. It wasn't, you know, precise enough. It didn't have the protocol that the moment deserved. And that, I think, took a couple of days for Turkey to take, you know, responsibility for American and British affairs in Libya, and then, you know, for us to sign the papers that gave them that right, and then for them to facilitate our transport to the border. So, you know, in the end, the delays may have been just, you know, diplomatic.
Were you able to talk to your captors about things like the no-fly zone?
Not really. You know, in fact, we had a brief conversation with, I assumed he was foreign ministry, but I'm not sure, he may have been defense ministry, but we asked, you know, how we were going to leave, and, you know, I think we understood the no-fly zone had been imposed, and he joked, well, we might send you out on a plane, and then he said, well, maybe we'll send you out on a military plane. And at first, I didn't get the humor. I didn't quite understand what he was saying, and then, you know, a couple minutes later, I realized, you know, he's making a joke. But another one of our captors who was very friendly came into our room at one point very upset that the no-fly zone had been imposed. He was watching state television, Libyan state television, that said dozens of civilians had been killed, and you could see that he was, you know, he was angry, he was agitated, and he said as much to us. And then another guy, you know, I said, I hope your family is safe. And he said to me, you know, this is politics.
Well, Tony, just one more question. We have just a few seconds. You're in Boston now. That's where we're talking to you. Are you planning to go back to Libya or any of the countries in the Middle East that are experiencing similar unrest?
You know, Leonard, I mean, I'm going back to Libya, going back to Lebanon next month when I'm a bureau chief. And I have to say, I've waited so many years to see this moment unfold in the Arab world, and it's tough to stay away from it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us today, Anthony Shadid of the New York Times.
My pleasure. Nice joining you.